This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com, especially for you. Who do you think said this? Action outranks contemplation. Action outranks contemplation. Is that General Patton? Or maybe Douglas MacArthur? Or maybe George Washington? No. Surprisingly, that quote is from Pope Innocent III, who was Pope from 1198 to 1216. He was a brilliant man. We know him as Pope Innocent III, but he had formerly been known as Lothar del Conti del Segni. Well, Pope Innocent had the gold and silver vessels removed from his table and replaced with wooden glass. He himself was served only three dishes, his chaplain only two. This brilliant pope wrote, "Action outranks contemplation," to one of his legates. We still have the letter in the archives. Elected unanimously at 37 years old, he died at 55. He was burned out by the effort to impose his ideals of theocratic absolutism on an unruly Europe. He spelled out his policy plainly enough in an encyclical dated the first year of his pontificate. Listen to Innocent III. "Just as God, founder of the universe, has constituted two large luminaries in the firmament of heaven, a major one to dominate the day and a minor one to dominate the night, so he has established in the firmament of the universal church two great dignities, a major one to preside, so to speak, over the days of the souls, and a minor one to preside over the nights of the bodies. They are pontifical authority, and the second is royal power. Most of the monarchs of the time would have been satisfied with the nights of the bodies, but Innocent claimed authority over those also." Well, Innocent III was attempting to reinstitute the archives, reinstitute the registers, the lists of documents, and the documents themselves, with the correspondence and writings of the popes. But in these centuries that we've just described in the previous parts of this series on the secret archives of the Vatican, for century after century, we have only remnants and copies until the papacy of Pope Innocent III. And even now, the time of disasters and the time of rebuilding overlapped. And before the fall and sacking of the sacred palace of the Lateran in Rome, where the archives were, in the Roman Revolution of 1234, the new documentation of the present secret archives started to accumulate. This was the beginning of the archives we have, although there are fragments of the archives before. The regular file of papal register now available to historians began with the six registers of this pope, Pope Innocent III. And this was a man who exercised his power as pope, and even considered he had power over the knights of the bodies. Well, then, as now, the pope had very few divisions. The wars of the Lord had to be fought with diplomacy and psychological warfare. But Innocent used these effectively and brought the papacy to the height of its power. He excommunicated kings and emperors, among them King John of England, who ultimately deeded his realm to the church. In return, John received it back as a papal fief and was promised help in resisting the Magna Carta. This arrangement was euphemistically called a donation, and the donation of John Lackland is one of the earliest documents in the present secret archives. Innocent also brought the peninsula of Italy under papal power, inaugurated the Albigensian Crusade, and continued the feud with the emperors. And they were a problem. The Catholics thought they'd gotten rid of Frederick Barbarossa when he went swimming in a pleasant river and drowned on his way to the Crusades. The Germans said he was only sleeping in a cave near Salzburg and said we would know he had returned when we heard his sword clattering on a rock in the time of Germany's greatest need. Well, he did reappear in a red-haired grandchild, the little king of Sicily. This little child was to grow up to be Frederick II, the grandchild of Frederick Barbarossa. The child became a ward of the pope, and therefore a pawn of international politics. Innocent wrote to him when he was 11 years old in terms that could be understood by a small boy. Listen to this letter. how much joy entered the apostolic scrinium of our heart when from the letter of your serenity we learned that the hand of the Lord had liberated you from the disgraceful custody of such people. How many times the dispatches of the nuncios have crossed each other as they came and went, taking to various parts of the world the messages that should have assured peace for you. How many times the letters sent for the sake of your well-being and that of your kingdom tired the pens of the notaries and dried the ink wells of the copyists, hoping in God that you may someday realize in your soul and in your deeds the care and benevolence of the apostolic seat, your mother. Well, it didn't work. Frederick grew up to hate the papacy and the hierarchy, and to be a thorn in the flesh of several popes. Yet before his outcast death, he wrote a strange chapter in history. Now and then, the medieval society produces an almost modern man. And a good example of that was Frederick II. He had genius and he had power too. And in his Sicilian kingdom, he ran a private renaissance. Like Charlemagne, he was in love with learning and he started with a far richer cultural background. He had scientific works of every age translated for him. Kept astronomers at his court, knew both Western and Arabic poetry. He had more faith in scientific truth than in God or immortality. At a time when the Mohammedan world was called, quote, the son of the slave of Egypt, and Christians were urged to follow the biblical injunction, send away the slave and her son, he lived in a manner as much Muslim as Christian. He maintained a harem, surrounded himself with Muslim scholars. When he was finally prodded into going reluctantly on crusade, the enemy emir sent to meet him and found his conversation delightful and was fascinated by what Frederick told him of Western culture. The crusade turned into a cultural mission. Eventually, the two men remembered what they were there for and arranged a truce, but these two new friends left out a step in the process. They left out the war. They went straight to the truce, and both the Muslim and the Christian worlds, observing this, found such behavior shocking. Well, despite all that, most of Pope Innocent's arrangements crumbled after his death. The Crusades failed. The Church lost control of the Italian peninsula. New heresies arose. England and the Empire went their stubborn ways. But like a prince who has been the patron of a great artist, Innocent achieved a lasting merit in the support he gave to the spiritual genius, St. Francis of Assisi. Yes, St. Francis of Assisi. Francis had grown up in the country of heretics, but instead of theorizing on the dualism of good and evil, of life and death, of spirit and substance, Francis developed a philosophy of love without limits for all men, for all creatures, both sentient and insentient. In the leper's disfigured body, there was always a man with his divine dignity. Around the jester of God gathered his disciples. They just called themselves the Fraticelli. They were young men of a type we know in our own day. There's a lot of Fraticelli around today. I had tons of Fraticelli friends in the 60s who despised their wealthy fathers and are willing to engage in hard manual labor, maybe in the Latin America and the Congo. They joined kibbutzes for a little while, and they longed to be slugged by a southern sheriff. To such men, Francis gave direction and comradeship. He said of them later, those who came to embrace this life presented all they had to the poor. They were happy to remain with only a tunic, a cord around the waist, and a pair of drawers. They did not want anything more. They weren't even allowed to handle money unless it was needed to help lepers or cure the sick. Listen to Francis, because for us money must not have any more importance or value than a stone. Each brother was permitted to own the tools of his craft. Actually, many of them worked as dishwashers or hustlers or daily work that could be gotten easily and given up when it was time to move on. They begged when they had to. St. Francis said this, if we're not to be paid for our work, let us call at God's table, asking for a little food from door to door, just like other poor men. Like acrobats and troubadours, the friars went singing from city to city of the happiness on which the sun would never set. So Franciscanism spread from Assisi to other cities. Francis decided to ask for papal authorization for his movement to quell the doubts of bishops and city officials, who felt there was something strange and irregular about these troubadours who sang the love of God on the lute and through the squares and countryside. So Francis and his 12 companions went to the Lateran Palace, where they were introduced by Cardinal Colonna. At his second audience, Pope Innocent said to him, "Go with God and preach as he inspires you. And when the Omnipotent multiplies you in number and in grace, come back to me, and I will give you greater missions." Then Pope Innocent warned him prophetically that as institutions prosper, they are likely to lose sight of their first aims. A later pope, Pope Honorius, elevated the Franciscans to the rank of the older orders by approving their rule, or regula. This statement of recognition, now in the secret archives, does end with a warning, like the ones on Egyptian tombs. If you read it, it says this: "No one of mankind may tear this page or contradict it with temerarious daring. If anyone attempts this, know my imperative, that he will incur the indignation of the omnipotent God and of the blessed apostles, Peter and Paul." Unquote. Francis was overjoyed at the recognition and went to Rome for the occasion and stayed with the Frangipani in their fortress palace. When he left, he gave Jacopo Frangipani a baby lamb as a symbol of purity and gentleness. We'll take a break now. Setting the Record Straight, Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. This is BreadboxMedia.com. So we're back with you after the break, talking about the Wandering Wayfaring Secret Archives of the Vatican. And we have just talked about the meeting between Pope Francis and the rather amazing Pope Innocent III, two amazing men in their own right. With St. Francis, a new element enters Christian theology. Not its devotion to poverty, that was there before, or the poor. Other saints show the same devotion. But his praise for all of God's creation. The canticle to the Son must have been said not with folded hands and bowed heads of a medieval man, but with the upraised arms of the early church. And in his feeling for the animal creation, he entered an area of ethics that is still almost unknown territory, terra incognita, to Western theology. The hermit saints in caves and desert huts had come to see their animal neighbors as individuals, and the dying St. Columba, nuzzled by an old cart horse, said, "Let him alone, he loves me." But this was regarded as a peculiarity of the saints, perhaps an aberration brought on by isolation. If here and there an old man saw the shadow of the Madonna in a mother bear holding her cub, he dismissed the thought as blasphemy. But Francis, preaching to the birds, his taming of the brother wolf, have entered into Christian mythology. His statue on the birdbaths of American gardens and the representation of St. Christopher on the traveler's meadows are the only images of saints generally used in the Protestant world. It may not be an accident that the two secular saints, Johnny Appleseed and Albert Schweitzer, both had this quality of reverence for all life. I mentioned Francis' taming of the brother wolf. I recorded that story some years ago. It's from the Little Flowers of St. Francis. Let's give a listen to that. At an early age, St. Francis of Assisi renounced all his worldly goods and became a wayfaring preacher.
In his sermons and writings, and by the actions of his own life, he inspired his followers to lead lives of voluntary poverty and simplicity. The movement he began revitalized the church of the Middle Ages. His own love of creation was so great that numerous tales comment on his ability to converse with the birds of the air and the beasts of the forest. This story is called St. Francis and the Wolf of Jubio, from the book The Little Flowers of St. Francis. At a time when St. Francis dwelt in the city of Jubio, there appeared in the neighborhood an enormous wolf, terrible and ferocious, which devoured not only animals, but even men also. Insomuch that all citizens stood in great terror, because many times he had approached the city. And all carried arms when they went out of the city, as though they were going to battle. And yet with all of this, if anyone met him alone, he could not defend himself against him. And for the fear of this wolf, it had come to pass that no one had the courage to go out of the city. Therefore, St. Francis had compassion on the men of the place and desired to go out to this wolf, although all the citizens together counseled him not to do so. And making the sign of the Most Holy Cross, he went out into the fields, he and his companions, all his confidence resting in God. And the others hesitating to go any further, St. Francis took his way to the place where the wolf was. And behold, seeing the many citizens who had come out to witness the miracle, the wolf made at St. Francis with open mouth. And when he had come near, St. Francis made on him the sign of the Most Holy Cross, and called to him, saying, "Come along, brother wolf, I command thee on the part of Christ that thou do no harm, neither to me nor to anyone." And oh wonder, immediately St. Francis spoke to him thus, "Brother wolf, you've done much damage in these parts, and many evil deeds, ravaging and killing the creatures of God without his permission, and not only killing and devouring the cattle, but having the hardihood to destroy men made in the image of God, for which cause thou dost deserve to be hung upon the gallows like a convict, as being a thief and the worst of murderers, and all the people cry out and murmur because of thee, and the whole neighborhood is hostile to thee. But, brother wolf, I would make peace between them and thee, so that thou offend no more, and they shall pardon thee all past offenses, and neither men nor dogs shall persecute thee more." At these words, the wolf, by the motions of his body and his tail and his eyes, and by inclining his head, showed that he accepted what St. Francis had said and was ready to observe it. "Brother wolf, since it pleases thee to make and to keep this peace, I promise thee that I shall have that food given to thee continually by the men of this place, as long as thou shalt live, so that thou shalt suffer no more hunger. For I know well that it is hunger which made thee do all this evil. But since I have obtained for thee this grace, I desire, brother wolf, that thou shalt promise me nevermore to harm man or beast. Dost thou promise me this?" And the wolf, by inclining his head, made evident signs that he promised. And St. Francis said to him, "Brother wolf, I would have thee pledge me thy faith that thou wilt keep this promise, without which I cannot well trust thee." And St. Francis, holding out his hand to receive his faith, the wolf immediately lifted up his right paw and gently placed it in the hand of St. Francis, thus giving him such pledge of faith as he was able. Then St. Francis said, "Brother wolf, I command thee in the name of Jesus Christ that thou come with me now without doubting of anything, and let us go and confirm this peace in the name of God." And the wolf obediently went with him like a mild and gentle lamb, which the citizens saw and marveled greatly. And immediately the news spread over the whole city, and all the people, men and women, great and small, young and old, thronged to the piazza to see the wolf with St. Francis. And all the people gathered together. St. Francis got up to preach, telling them, among other things, how it was on account of sin that God permitted such calamities. Much more terrible, he said, are the flames of hell, which the damned will have to endure eternally, than the fangs of the wolf, which cannot destroy more than the body. How much more then are the jaws of hell to be feared, when we see so many held in terror by the jaws of a little animal? Turn therefore, beloved, to God, and do worthy penance for your sin, and God will deliver you now from the fires of hell. And the sermon ended. Saint Francis said, Brother Wolf, who is here before you, has promised and pledged me his faith to make peace with you, and never to offend again in anything. And you will promise to give him every day that which is necessary, and I will make myself surety for him that he will faithfully observe the treaty of peace. The people promised with one voice to feed him continually. And Saint Francis before them all said to the wolf, And thou, brother wolf, dost thou promise to observe and keep the treaty of peace, that thou wilt not offend either man or beast or any creature? And the wolf knelt down and inclined his head, and by gentle movements of his body and his tail and his ears, showed as well as he could that he was willing to keep all that he had promised to them. Then said Saint Francis, Brother Wolf, I desire, as thou hast pledged me thy faith to this promise outside the gates, wilt thou pledge me thy faith again before all the people, and not deceive me in this promise and guarantee which I have given for thee? Then the wolf, lifting up his right paw, placed it in the hand of Saint Francis. Whilst this and the rest that has been told above was taking place, there was such joy and admiration among all the people, both through devotion to the saint, and through the novelty of the miracle, and on account of the peace made with the wolf, that all began to cry to heaven, praising and blessing God for sending them Saint Francis, who by his merits had delivered them from the jaws of the cruel beast. And after this, the said wolf lived 2 years in Jubio, and went sociably into the houses, going from door to door without doing harm to anyone, or anyone doing harm to him, and was continually entertained by the people. And then as he went through the fields and lanes, never did any dog bark at him. Finally, after 2 years, Brother Wolf died of old age, after which the citizens grieved much. For whilst he went so gently about the town, they remembered the virtue and sanctity of Saint Francis.
So that's one story about St. Francis. There's a whole lot of other ones about St. Francis preaching to the birds. You can read the little book, The Little Flowers of St. Francis. That's one story. But I have another one. It's something that happened that's real. It happened to a very good friend of mine. And I want to tell you that story right after the break so you can hear it in uninterrupted fashion. St. Francis' teachings really have had an enormous effect. There are so many organizations today for the protection of animals and so widespread recognition of the protection of animals. Still, once in a while, in extremely politically correct cities, little old ladies are occasionally being arrested for feeding the pigeons. Yet Francis has given some theological sanction, some very omnipresent touch of church approval, Catholic Church approval, to those who believe in the rights for all the citizens of the planet, no matter how small. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com. I'll see you on the other side of this break.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Redboxmedia.com is Chuck Coughlin back after the break, setting the record straight about the wandering wayfarer in Vatican archives, about the secret archives of the Vatican in their stage of wandering and wayfaring around the world, which we're coming to that a little in this segment. But first, I want to tell a story that was real, that actually took place. It happened to a friend of mine. Because I'd mentioned before the break about the garden statues of St. Francis. They're everywhere. I don't think it matters whether it's a Jewish, Catholic, or Protestant garden. You see statues of St. Francis, perhaps with his arms out with a bird bath or feeding the birds. Yes, St. Francis preaching to the birds. It's a legend, but it has its basis in reality. There are many stories about him preaching to the birds, and that seemed to have some basis in reality, too. So everybody, every rough character knows St. Francis and knows him from those statues. My friend, who was quite wealthy, a multimillionaire, had this gorgeous house set in a tropical jungle on an island, Sanibel Island, Captive Island, just off the southwestern coast of the tip of Florida. It's a very exclusive community, and he had several acres there. And he would lend me this house sometimes, and because he was often in Paris with his wife. His wife was Parisian. And I would have my friends over. We'd have great weekends. He had a beautiful beach as part of his property. His property went all the way from the road to the beach. And he needed to have someone living there all the time because I couldn't be there except on weekends, and other friends. He just couldn't cover it. He wanted somebody there. So he hired a housekeeper, a very nice lady in her 40s, very pleasant lady, very domestic, quite a good cook. My friend was a Catholic. And once we were driving around and he saw in a roadside market some garden statues, concrete, not expensive, and this sort of white statue of St. Francis. It's about 4 feet tall. It's pretty heavy. But together we got it in the back of his car and we took it home, and he wanted to put it in a wonderful place. And he had this sand path that wound through the palms and ferns and sea grapes out to the beach. And so we installed St. Francis right at the foot of the path looking out to sea on the little sand dune there. And it looked wonderful. We would go out swimming and look back, and we could see St. Francis in the moonlight. St. Francis sort of glowed in this whitewashed state. So once upon a time, my friend was away in Paris, and I was very busy, and I didn't get over to his house often, and started to acquire a house of my own in a far less desirable location, but in the same general vicinity. There's a number of people in Florida who make their living by caring for the large boats of millionaires who are too busy to be on the boats. And they ferry them north and south in the winter. So, in the winter, they pilot the boats down the Tentum Canal or the Intercoastal Waterway, bring them from the north to the south for the winter. It can take 2 weeks. So a wealthy businessman has no time to do that. He hires a trained boat captain to bring his boat down for him. It's a long trip. Some boat owner, who we never found who it was, had contracted with two gentlemen from, and I presume they were gentlemen, from somewhere in Philadelphia to ferry that boat owner's vessel down to somewhere in around Marco Island, south of where we were. And they came down the west coast of Florida. Things were going well for them. And then a fairly severe storm hit, and it sort of frightened them a little bit. They weren't used to the open water, and they got a little disoriented as to where they were, and the waters calmed down so that they could pull in close to the shoreline. They were looking for some place to anchor for the night, to rest, and let's admit it, to find out where the heck they were. So they took a large searchlight and start searching along the shoreline, looking for a place where they might pull in, maybe an inlet or someplace, where they might pull in an anchor. And as they went along the shoreline for miles and miles, they couldn't see anything, and just vegetation that was bordered on the beach. But the fog was extremely dense, and it was difficult to see anything or distinguish objects. And then all of a sudden, they saw this white object shining. And one of them said to the other, "Look at that. What's that?" And he said, "I don't know." And they got out the binoculars, and the boat was still heaving up and down a little bit. But then they got a focus on what it was. And one of them said to the other, "It's St. Francis. It's St. Francis of Assisi. Thank God we're saved. That's a good sign. That's a sign of hospitality. Maybe we could just anchor here." The water's fairly calm, so they did anchor. Got the boat secure, then they dove in and swam to shore. And they approached the St. Francis statue, and they looked around and said, "Well, It's a good sign. It's a good sign. Then they looked back through the trees and they saw a light shining on a two-story house. So they went up the path past St. Francis and knocked on the door. And Sarah, the housekeeper, came to the door and she said yes. And they told their story. They said, "We're lost. And we don't know what to do. We don't know where to go." And they were wet. And I'm told they were shivering a little bit. And there was an autumnal chill in the air. And she said, "Well," she looked at these two large, hulking gentlemen and said, "Well, come on in and sit down. I'll get you a cup of coffee. You look so cold." And so she got them towels and they dried it off. And then she said, "Are you hungry?" And they said, "Well, yeah." And she said, "Well, I've got a great stew here. Let me fix you some." And so they did that. So it was getting pretty late. And the fog was becoming more dense. It hadn't lifted. But several times they went out to take a look, see if the boat was all right, see if conditions were any better. And she went with them. And they said, "Well, we could go. We're going to go back out to the boat." She said, "But it's such a foggy night. Where are you going to go? The boat's pretty safe here." And they stood around, shifting from foot to foot with St. Francis, and thought a moment. She said, "Well, it's all right if you spend the night, I guess." And so they came on in, and they did that. Now, several weeks passed, and my friend, unannounced, suddenly came back from Paris, flew into the Fort Myers airport, and took a limousine out to Captive Island. And they let him out at his end of his driveway. He walked down the driveway. It was mid-afternoon, and he started up the stairs. Like all the houses in that area, they're up on pilings. He heard a voice that said, "Hold on there." And halfway up the stairs, my friend turned around and looked at the bottom of the stairs. Was this big, blonde, athletic-looking, muscular guy, tanned, staring up at him. He said, "Where do you think you're going?" And he said, "Well, I'm going up into the house." And he said, "I'm sorry, you can't go. You're trespassing here." He said, and my friend said, and he gave his name. The blonde guy glared back at him and said, "I don't know who you are. You're trespassing." Well, my friend was speechless for a minute. And then he said, "I live here." And the guy looked at him and said slowly, "Listen, Sarah didn't say something about anybody living here that had that name. Well, who's living here? It's none of your business. It's Sarah and my buddy and I." He said, "Where is she?" He said, "Well, she's at the grocery." He said, "Well, I'm going on there." He said, "No, you're not." He said, "Come back down here." So my buddy looked at him. My buddy's about 55 years old and not very tall, actually. So he came back down, and they stood there for a few minutes staring at each other. And my friend took out his wallet and showed him his address. And he said, "This is where I live." He said, "It is, isn't it?" He said, "Well, Sarah didn't say anything about you." He said, "Well, I'm her boss. She works for me. She's my housekeeper." He said, "I thought it was her house." So the guy said, "Why don't you just sit here till she gets back?" So they had to sit outside. So my buddy decided to go down the path to the beach and sit out there and wait, get a little sun. And the guy followed him. And the guy said, "We have a lot of trouble with tourists trying to use this beach. It's a private beach." My buddy said, "It's my beach. And this is my house. And you're the one that's not welcome here." He said, "Are you the one that put that St. Francis statue out?" He said, "Yeah, it was." And the blonde guy scratched his head and looked at him and says, "I don't get it. It's supposed to be a symbol of welcoming. You know, the monks always put out the hospitality for travelers. Put them up. People that are in trouble." And so the man told my buddy his story, and Alan recognized that St. Francis had led these people into believing that they would be welcome at his house. Well, they weren't welcome at his house. And soon as Sarah got back, he put them out. Rather rudely, I hear. The more my buddy found out about what had happened and how many groceries had been eaten, he got really worked up and angry. He fired Sarah. Then he called me and told me the story. He said, "You coming over this weekend?" I said, "Yeah, I'm coming. I'm sorry you had a problem." And he said, "It's all the fault of that St. Francis." He said, "He gave him a false impression that we could just take any old tramp that's ferrying a boat south past the shoreline here, seeing a statue and assuming things, and come over and spend weeks in my house and eating all the food. And the grocery bill I've got is enormous. Those two must have eaten like horses." So the more he went over the story with me, the madder he was getting. He said, "Give me a hand." He said, "What are you going to do?" And he went and picked up the St. Francis statue. I said, "Take it easy, man. You can't pick that up." He did. I didn't think he was strong enough, but he was. He raised the statue up over his head, and he weighed it out. with a statue over his head until he was about up to his chest, and then with all his might he heaved it out into the water. There is a ledge there, a drop-off, and he was able to get it over that so it fell into where it was really deep. Of course, while he was wading out, I said, "You can't do that. That's St. Francis. You're not telling me what to do. The statue was a mistake. I'm not having somebody come into my house, come and think they can come in my house and eat the food and carry on with the housekeeper." Well, that statue is still down there. I saw it a few years ago when I was snorkeling along there. And somebody must have gone down and set it up. It's upright. So I guess it's another one of those underwater sacramentals, seemingly placed there to inspire people who are scuba diving or snorkeling. So that's my story about St. Francis and how his spirit didn't completely change the world, did it? But St. Francis is still down there working on it among the creatures of the sea. I think there's a moral in this story for human beings, too. But every time I think about it, I'm not sure what the moral is. But we'll take a break, and I'll go back to talking about the archives after that break. This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
On BreadboxMedia.com, I'm Chuck Coughlin, back with you after the break. I hope you enjoyed the stories about St. Francis, a little tangential to our stories about the archives, but I thought it would be interesting. But let's talk about Pope Innocent back in the 1200s. It was this pope who began to shift the life of the church, including part of the papal archives, from the Lateran Hill and the Lateran Palace to the Vatican. Shortly before his time, the Lateran had been fortified so well that it was now called the Palace of the High Walls, and the surrounding towers that menaced it had been pulled down. Remember the war among the towers? But it was still less defensible than the Vatican. That was across the river. He had already rebuilt the Vatican Palace that Pope Symmachus had constructed about the year 500, and that Charlemagne had enlarged and enriched. And Innocent had provided new quarters for the chamberlains and for the chancellery. It was to the chamberlains, they were called camerari, that was entrusted the care of the Sarum Nostrum et Ecclesia Romani, which contained the Pope's personal treasure, along with that of the church, gold and silver objects and gems, parchments, documents, the registers, and most importantly, precious codices. The chancellery, charged with preparing, dispatching, and preserving in registers the correspondence and acts of the popes, was headed by a cardinal. Under him were various officers. Some of these composed the pope's letters and prepared the rough copies of the papal acts. When these letters and acts had been revised and approved in the final form, other officials registered them. That is, they copied them into the register. They registered them. Or perhaps they copied on parchment sheets that were later to be bound into registers. Different popes used sheets of different sizes, but all of a given pope's letters were normally copied on the same size of parchment. The parchment sheets were folded. In this way, two smooth white sheets faced each other, and two rough yellow sheets faced each other, so that the eye did not notice the dissonance of color and textures. You've heard the word bulls. Here's where that comes from. The pope's official documents, edicts and decrees, and the seals affixed to them were called bulls. The papal seals are round balls of lead attached to the document with silken or hempen cords. The letters with silken cords of red or yellow were likely to be documents granting a favor or pardon. In some periods, the recipient could tell whether a letter from a pope brought him good or bad news as soon as he saw the cords that held the bulla. Now, the papacy rarely used golden bulls, except for great occasion, such as the appointment of Henry VIII as defender of the faith, for a paradoxical example. On the other hand, the kings and emperors who wrote to the Pope often used bowls of gold and silver. This favorable balance of trade enabled the papal treasury to build up an excellent collection of precious bulls. The secret archives file of papal registers, as we know, is not complete. Often a register is missing, or a gap in dates show that not all the folded sheets that should have been bound into a volume have been included. Some of these losses may have been due to the fact that the popes, in their frequent travels in Italy and abroad, took with them in their baggage trains the archived documents that might be needed, along with part of their chancellery. So this is the title of this program, The Wandering Wayfaring Vatican Archives. These traveling documents were called Scrinia Vittoria, the Wayfaring Archives, and were carried in iron trunks with rounded tops banded with strips of iron and fastened with enormous padlocks. Modern popes go to Castel Gandolfo for the summer months, but medieval popes had many country retreats that served less as places of rest and recreation than places of refuge. When Rome or other parts of Italy became temporarily unlivable and untenable, it was wise to have a choice of castles, and they prepared fortified palaces in Assisi, Viterbo, Perugia, and Orvieto. One has some idea of the splendor of these papal country houses when he sees the Hall of Audiences in the palace at Orvieto, with its series of great arched windows overlooking the plain. Sometimes all of Italy was unsafe, and the popes fled to France until the political climate changed. Between the years of 1058 and 1304, the popes traveled a great deal in Italy and France. In 2.5 centuries, they were away from Rome for more than 100 years. Often they undertook long trips to attend conferences of state. Travel was so slow that they, like the emperors, found it necessary to follow a policy of govern as you go and took with them archives, documents that might be needed for reference. For a political conference, they took only what might later be called cabinet papers. But for an extended stay, the papers might constitute a large mass of archives. The transferring of important documents sometimes led to their destruction or dispersion, especially if the popes were involved in armed skirmishes. But they didn't travel with the bulk of the archives. No. That was stationary, which remained in their normal location, perhaps no safer than the mule trains of the popes. They were the stationary archives, the Archiva Stataria, Archivia Amaria, or Scrinia Palatii, the stationary kept in closet archives in the scrinium of the palace. There were three groups, the Archiva Stataria, the stationary archives, the kept-in-closets archives, called the Archiva Amaria, and the Scrinium of the Palace, the Scrinia Palatii. However, the loss of archives through travels of the popes was often lessened by the fact that copies rather than the originals were taken. For example, when Innocent IV, in his conflict with Frederick II, transferred his ecclesiastical court to Lyons for 6.5 years, he took with him as supporting evidence the most important grants of privilege and donations to the Holy See. But he did not take the originals, only copies on long parchment rolls. One of these, known as the Cluny Roll, is still to be found in the National Library of Paris, the Bibliothèque de Nationale. It would be nice to have a more complete description of these papal baggage trains. But I'm not able to find anything like that that really describes them and what they were like. However, the register of the Apostolic Camera gives the details of the trip made by Paul III to Bologna in 1543, which is very likely to be similar to those papal baggage trains, those mule trains. The document is entitled The Book of Mules and Other Conveyances for the Trip of Paul III to Bologna and Other Places, 1543. How do you like that? The Book of Mules and Other Conveyances for the Trip of Paul III to Bologna and Other Places, 1543. So the mule book lists the allotment of mules required to carry the luggage of various functions, such as the Pope's kitchen and his dining room, and of various individuals. The Pope took with him 2 mule loads of wax and 1 mule load of lead, an indication that they did a considerable amount of office work while they were underway. I guess they had to govern on the road. But only 3 mules were allotted to the chancellery. Perhaps some of its equipment was carried on the wagons, or perhaps the business was to be largely financial, for 15 or more mules were allotted to the chamberlains. The treasurer had 3 mules. Their loads may have included books and documents. Much of the mule book deals with the allotments of individuals. Some had 4 mules, others a quarter of a mule.
Since a mule carried 2 saddlebags, one on either side, that was a quarter mule is a half a saddlebag.
One has the impression that the status at that time could be measured in mules, as modern executives might measure it in corner windows.
During this period, there was a time that the church had been 2 years without a pope because they were deadlocked between the Colonna and Orsini factions. It was quite a competition.
Then, as often happens with people with a troubled conscience, the cardinals went to the other extreme, and instead of electing a nepotistic pope, they elected a saint. The hermit Pietro de Mironi was 80 years of age when he was elected. The year was 1294. His name was Peter Pietro. He was of peasant origin. He had spent most of his life at a mountain hermitage near Sulmona. His personality and the reports of his miracles had drawn other hermits to him, and his fame spread so he found it necessary to set aside part of every day for counseling people who came to consult him. Now, in the secret archives, there is a document that they say is Peter's autobiography. Its subtitle is, "This is the life that the Holy Father wrote that was found in his cell," unquote. Now, evidently, he wrote it as the last thing he did when he had to leave his monks and leave his cell to become a pope. Very probably the author was one of his disciples, some scholars say, who had lived near him and heard him talk about his life.
But scholars and historians have a tendency to enlarge their own reputation as honest skeptics by chipping away at the reputations of men far greater than they.
The little book is full of miracles, but they were not considered in the process for canonization, probably because of the lack of sustaining evidence. All his visions are of a very imaginative kind. He tells of a celestial singing that he heard on the first night of his solitude in the mountains. It lasted even after he awakened, long enough for him to say a Paternoster. A mysterious bell always awoke him in the morning at the time for prayers, until he made the mistake of accepting the gift of a rooster. Well, he gave the rooster back, but the bell never rang again. Demons came to him in the shape of women that he had known when he was in the world. The archives also contains a letter. It's a rather astonished letter that the Holy College of Cardinals sent to advise him of his election. It says this, quote,
"To the Lord Brother Pietro di Moroni,
of the Order of St. Benedict, elected highest in Roman Pontifex by the divine providence, who like the wind turns where he will." While Peter pleaded incompetence, he knew that the papacy involved administrative responsibilities that he was unable to meet, but his old patron King Charles of Naples offered to advise him, and Peter consented to be consecrated as Pope, if it could be done in a country chapel at Aquila in the mountains east of Rome. Afterward, instead of going to Rome, he set up a temporary papal court in Naples, where he managed to live fairly comfortably by having a wooden hut put up in a corner of the garden of the palace of King Charles.
I thank you for listening in.